VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. Days after a Democratic senator scuttled talks on a new environmental package, U.S. President Joe Biden is set to announce his own climate change steps today. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president will visit a former coal-fired power plant in Massachusetts that's shifting to offshore wind manufacturing. It's the type of transition to clean energy the president's been seeking but found trouble making reality amid congressional opposition.
He has been taking decisive action.
But spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre says the next step will not include something activists and Democratic lawmakers want.
I would not plan announcement this week on national climate emergency.
Though she says it's still on the table. Such a declaration would let the president redirect federal resources to boost renewable energy programs. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Last hour, the White House climate advisors said President Biden plans to unveil more executive actions on climate change in the next few weeks. The shift in climate is leading to more wildfires and will force France and the European Union to take, quote, structural decisions, end quote, President Emmanuel Macron said Wednesday. He said, quote, great fires are accelerating, end quote, citing climate change as the cause. Macron made the remarks while visiting the wine-growing Gironde region, which saw its biggest wildfires in over 30 years. Roughly 20,000 hectares of forest were affected. Greek authorities said on Wednesday they'd brought under control a wildfire in mountains near Athens that forced hundreds of people to flee and damaged homes and cars. This is VOA News. Outgoing British Prime Minister Boris Johnson held his last Prime Minister's Questions in the House of Commons Wednesday. In his closing remarks, he gave advice to whoever will succeed him.
Number one, stay close to the Americans, stick up for the Ukrainians, stick up for freedom and democracy everywhere. Cut taxes and deregulate wherever you can to make this the greatest place to live and invest, which it is.
He said he's helped get the country through a pandemic and helped, quote, save another country from barbarism, end quote. And then this, his final send-off.
Hasta la vista, baby. Thank you.
Britain's Conservative Party chose Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss as finalists to replace Johnson as party leader and prime minister. He resigned under pressure from numerous scandals earlier this month. His replacement will be announced September 5th. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi demanded unity Wednesday among his coalition partners if they wanted him to stay in office, leaving his resignation threat hanging over Parliament. Draghi set out a series of issues facing Italy ranging from the war in Ukraine to social inequality and rising prices, and said political parties needed to get behind him if he was to steer the country to elections due in the first half of 2023. Lawmakers in Sri Lanka have chosen six-time Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe as the country's new president. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma has more.
Lawmakers thumped tables after choosing Wickremesinghe as president to succeed the ousted leader Gotabaya Rajapaksa, who's fled the country, in a vote that risks reigniting political turmoil in the troubled South Asian island. Wickremesinghe's unpopular with voters who see him as a holdover from Rajapaksa's government. Namal Jayawira, a human resources professional, reflects the view of many.
They have failed us because they have not listened to the people's demands. People are struggling. They can't have food. They can't have kerosene, they don't have gas, they don't have diesel, they don't have petrol.
Other protesters chant, go home, Ranil. I'm Charles de la Desma.
Ivana Trump's funeral mass is underway in New York City. She is the ex-wife of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Her three children with him, Ivanka, Don Jr., and Eric, are there with other mourners, gathering at a Catholic church on Manhattan's Upper West Side. Authorities say the 73-year-old's death last week was an accident after a fall down the stairs at her townhouse. And recapping our top story, U.S. President Joe Biden is set to announce climate change today in Massachusetts. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
The This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
He reached a point where he could not allow it. He became so weak and he couldn't even talk.
That was Chimwemwe Shawa, spokesperson for the Malawi Prison Service, on the death of a priest convicted recently in connection with the murder of an albino. Details coming up. Also, for the first time, Cameroon's defense minister has acknowledged grave rights abuses by the military against civilians. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Mali's military government has given Oliver Salgado, the spokesperson for the UN mission to Mali, 72 hours to leave the country. The order comes after he tweeted that the Malian government was informed of the arrival of 49 Ivorian soldiers as support for a UN contingent. The soldiers were arrested at Bamako's airport on July 10th. Annie Reisenberg reports from Bamako.
Mali's Foreign Affairs Ministry posted the statement on its social media accounts Wednesday. The statement said that Salgado is being expelled due to unacceptable publications on Twitter, where he claimed Malian authorities were previously informed of the arrival of 49 Ivorian soldiers to Mali on July 10th. The Malian government has maintained that it was not informed of the arrival of the soldiers and claimed in a July 11th statement that the soldiers were present in Mali to break the dynamics of the refoundation and security of Mali. The soldiers arrived for what Salgado said in a tweet was logistical support on behalf of one of our contingents, though they were not present as official contingent forces for Mali's UN mission, MINUSMA. The soldiers were arrested on their arrival at Bamako's airport, with the government claiming that they are mercenaries. Following the arrest, Mali suspended all rotations of UN forces in Mali until further notice. Ivory Coast has called for the soldiers' release. MINUSMA has supported the Malian army in maintaining security in much of the country since its creation in 2013. Tensions between the UN and Mali's military government have been rising in recent months, with the UN being denied access to the town of Mora in April, where they wished to carry out a human rights investigation of an alleged massacre. When MINUSMA's mandate in Mali was renewed during a Security Council meeting on June 29th, Mali's representative to the UN stated that the government would not be permitting the UN to carry out any human rights investigations. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
For the first time, Cameroon's defense minister has acknowledged grave rights abuses by the military against civilians in the fight against Anglophone rebels and ordered such violations to stop. Cameroon's military has characterized past abuses, including torture and killings, as isolated incidents. Rights groups and victims welcome the call, while voicing doubt the abuses will end. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Cameroonian Defense Minister Joseph Betty Asomu says he is instructing top commanders to immediately arrest and bring charges against troops engaged in rights abuses in English-speaking Western regions. He says troops who fail to respect Cameroonian laws and the Code of Military Conduct, which forbids human rights violations in times of armed conflict, will be severely punished. Asomo spoke in Bamenda Tuesday while officially installing Brigadier Generals Buba Dobe Creo and Useni Jibo as commanders of government troops fighting separatists. Asomo did not elaborate on what he called grave human rights violations. He called on Dobe Creo and Jibo to make sure that all human rights are respected while fighting separatists who seek to carve out an independent state from Cameroon and its French-speaking majority. It was the first time the defense minister has spoken publicly about the issue. In June, military spokesperson Colonel Cyril Serge Atonfa-Gemu said troops were responsible for killings in Misong, a northwestern village, that month. In a June 7 press release, Atongfak said four soldiers deployed to investigate the deaths of their colleagues killed nine civilians, including four women and a baby. Etienne Akenfor is a rights activist with the Cameroon Civil Society Group. He has been pressing for the four soldiers linked to the Misong incident to be tried. Akinfo said he is skeptical the military will allow troops who receive orders to kill suspected fighters and their collaborators to face justice. If the government was serious about its claims to punish troops, Akinfo added, it should have arrested top military officials suspected of giving the orders.
The situation keeps getting worse when new military generals are brought in. So I think the way out of this situation will be to send the army back to the barracks. If there were a ceasefire, you not have troops on the field committing atrocities.
Akinfo said he was surprised to learn that General Cavalier, commander of troops who committed atrocities in the English-speaking Northwest within the past 3 years, was not called on to answer charges. Instead, Akinfo said Kao was appointed by President Biya as the head of the Yaounde International War College last week. Cameroonian officials say at least 13 soldiers are currently in pre-trial detention for offenses including rape, extrajudicial killings, and the burning down of civilian homes. Advocacy group Human Rights Watch recently said Cameroon's announcement of an investigation into the Misong village killings is an important first step in ensuring accountability around the murder of civilians, allegedly by government troops. Human Rights Watch says Cameroon now needs to ensure a thorough, impartial and independent investigation capable of establishing a clear timeline of events and the identification of all those responsible, including in the chain of command, with an aim toward prosecution. Rights groups have also accused separatists of abuses, a charge the separatists deny. The separatists blame the military and armed groups in western regions. In April 2020, the military bowed to international pressure and acknowledged that its troops were responsible for killing 3 women and 10 children in February of that year in Garbu, a northwestern village. Rights groups and the United Nations said at least 21 people were killed, 14 of them children. The military said troops tried to cover up the killing by burning houses and putting the blame on separatist fighters. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaounde, Cameroon.
A Catholic priest in Malawi who was recently sentenced to 30 years in prison in connection with the murder of an albino man has died in jail. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
Prison authorities say the 50-year-old Thomas Muhosha died Tuesday, a week after being taken to a public hospital in Zomba District for depression that led to mental illness. Chimwemwe Sha was the spokesperson for the Malawi Prison Service.
We may not be, exact on the cause of death, but then the reason for his admission was depression and psychosis. That is according to the preliminary diagnosis.
Shawa said Muhosha's illness grew so severe that he could not carry out basic functions.
He reached a point where he could not now eat, he became so weak, and he couldn't even talk.
Muhosha was among 12 people the High Court in Malawi sentenced last month in connection with the 2018 murder of 24-year-old McDonald Masambuka, a man with albinism. Masambuka disappeared from his village on March 9, 2018. Less than a month later, his limbless body was found buried in the garden at a home where one of the assailants lived in the Machinga district in the south of Malawi. Malawi is one of the several African countries where albinos face attacks, usually prompted by witch doctors who use their body parts in so-called magic potions. Muhosha was among 5 people sentenced to 30-year jail terms on charges of transacting inhuman tissues extracted from the body of Masambuka. Young Mahamba is the president of the Association of People with Albinism. He says the death of Muhosha is a blow to efforts to stop attacks on albinos.
If we see prisoners like this dying, it becomes difficult because we believe that some of the information which those prisoners have may not be revealed again. So this is a bad development to us as persons who are here.
The Catholic Church had been in the process of removing Muhosha from the priesthood. Earlier this month, Malawi's government ordered police to investigate former President Peter Mutharika and his former aide, Heather Wikintaba, in connection with the murder of Masambuka. Both Mutharika and Ntaba deny any connection. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
While President Joe Biden pledged to raise human rights issues in Cairo, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi highlighted the importance of the bilateral partnership in promoting peace and stability in the Middle East. Sisi affirmed Egypt's hope for further coordination and consultation with the U.S. on various issues of common interest, without mentioning democracy and human rights. Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, explained Sisi's focus to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi.
President Sisi just reminded the Biden administration of the strategic importance of Egypt so as not to ignore it and depend on other regional players alone. So he just told them, remember what we are doing and our importance in Gaza, in the Red Sea, in the Palestinian conflict, in many issues. So don't forget that. And that's why I'm trying to emphasize and stress the bilateral strategic dialogue between Egypt and the United States. This is what only he did.
The Egyptian national dialogue was described as a window dressing before Sisi's Biden meeting. Do you expect a real change in the political scene in Egypt following the resumption of the national dialogue this week?
Egypt under Sisi is trying to create the Mubarak political system with less strict policies. And so in last year, he ended the emergency laws. He introduced the National Strategy for Human Rights. He began to talk about a national dialogue. And Egypt is also hosting the climate change summit in Sharm el-Sheikh in November. And so all those things are aiming at giving a new look to the regime. And the regime is so far providing those images. And the West is not criticizing anything. I mean, they are accepting that. Nobody is saying anything. We are seeing Sisi meeting Biden. He went to Germany. He talks to top European officials. So far, this is going on. Regarding the credibility of all this movement, you have to talk to Egyptian opposition if this is really working or not.
That was Said Sadiq, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. With 2.5 weeks to go, Kenya's presidential race is too close to call. The top two candidates have booked the same stadium on the same day for their final rally, a potentially volatile situation in a country that has been racked by violence in previous elections. Four candidates are in the running, but Deputy President William Ruto and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga have emerged as the strong front runners, drawing thousands of people to their rallies around the country. The French news agency AFP reported both of these parties say they have reserved Nairobi's Nyayo National Stadium for the last campaign day, August 6th, 3 days before the vote. Last month, police fired tear gas to disperse stone-throwing supporters of the two candidates when they clashed over access to a campaign venue in the east of Nairobi, forcing Ruto to take cover. More than 1,100 people died during the 2007 election. Some 22.1 million Kenyans are eligible to vote. President Uhuru Kenyatta has served the maximum of 2 5-year terms. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken yesterday released the 2022 Trafficking in Persons Report, which is aimed at encouraging governments to beef up their anti-trafficking efforts. The report paints a mixed picture of success. The United Nations says 25 million people around the world are still in some form of forced labor. Have traffickers come up with new ways to dupe people and force them into slavery? VOA's Carol Van Dam puts that question to Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking, a U.S.-based coalition that combats forced labor and sex trafficking in more than 100 countries.
They have. Unfortunately, governments haven't come up with new ways to stop them. I think the most important two words that Secretary of State Antony Blinken used in introducing the report to the public was a mixed picture of success. So what the report does is rank countries around the world by tiers. Tier one is the best. Those countries are found to be doing what's necessary, meeting the minimum conditions necessary to effectively combat traffickers through prosecutions, through prevention programs, and through protection of survivors. Only 30 countries and only one country in Africa met that list, and that was Namibia. The reality is the rest of the world, the vast majority of the world, do not meet those minimum conditions, and 22 countries aren't even trying.
Let's stay on Africa for a minute. You mentioned Namibia is the one country that seems to be cooperating. Paint a picture of some of the other countries in Africa and where they stand. Human trafficking, forced labor, which are both part of this problem.
Sure. If you look at a map of Africa in the TIP report, it color codes the different countries. And green is the color code in favor of being on tier one. You're hitting on all cylinders and doing what's necessary. Africa's a sea of orange and red and yellow for the other tiers, showing that those countries aren't effectively prosecuting, aren't effectively protecting people from traffickers, aren't effectively protecting those who are in trouble or targeted by traffickers or are on the way out, on the backside, are survivors who have escaped or been rescued. So it's a bit of a disappointing picture in that when we think about modern slavery, we immediately, the word slavery sends our mind back to 150 years ago, 200 years ago, where people were kidnapped from Africa and brought to Europe or to Asia or to the Americas. Well, unfortunately, today, in modern forms of slavery, it's happening right inside Africa, in mines, on fishing boats, at farms, inside brothels. And so we see children and women and adults who are kept in place through forced fraud and coercion.
Even here in the United States, we're not immune to that. We are found guilty, people in our country, of bringing in these domestic workers that are illegal, right?
Yes. Inside the United States, there's a system of guest worker visas, which are known as the H-2A and H-2B program. And then something also called the J-1 visa program for people who are camp counselors or au pairs or other kind of summer or seasonal work. These are people coming into the United States on legitimate visas. And often they find themselves in domestic work as maids or nannies or au pairs or working as gardeners or other kind of seasonal help. And they find themselves stuck to an employer and they cannot leave.
Which would you say are the people that are most often targeted around the world?
In some countries, a prevalent form of forced labor might be domestic servitude, say people migrating to South Africa and end up working as maids or as gardeners. In other places, it's cocoa plantations or rubber plantations in West Africa.
That was Terry Fitzpatrick, director of the Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. The breakaway region of Somaliland has announced a ban on broadcasts by the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. Meanwhile, a Somali press freedom group has condemned police for beating and arresting two TV journalists this week in Mogadishu. Mohamed Desene reports from Mogadishu, Somalia.
Somaliland Information Minister Salevan Yusuf Ali Kore told reporters Tuesday that BBC broadcasts have reduced the identity and dignity of the self-declared independent nation not recognized by Somalia or any other country The minister, speaking in the Somaliland capital of Hargeisa, said that after long discussions, authorities decided to ban the BBC on the grounds that the network has lost its neutrality and is acting against the independence of Somaliland. He said the ban would go into effect immediately.
BBC waxay aqoonsan wayday in ay tahay dal demokraadiya.
He says the BBC refuses to recognize that Somaliland is a democratic country that has stood on its feet for the last 31 years, held elections with 5 presidents holding office and 3 parliamentary elections, and still the BBC uses words that the Somaliland people don't deserve to hear. Somaliland is a former British protectorate and breakaway region of northern Somalia that declared independence in 1991 after Somalia descended into a civil war. In Somalia, meanwhile, journalists and media houses are facing new challenges for their daily activities. On Monday, a reporter and a cameraman working for Arladi Media, a Mogadishu radio and TV station, were arrested by security forces, according to station director Ahmed Ali Noor. Noor said our journalists and photographer was attacked, fired at with live bullets, beaten and arrested. Their equipment was taken, some of it destroyed while doing their job. Since yesterday's incident, we haven't received any information and we demand to get it. Fansa is one of the journalists who was assaulted. He says, while we were covering a story about the street damage caused by recent rains in Mogadishu, I was beaten at a gunpoint by security forces without them telling us why they did what they did to us. After they beat us, they took my cameraman to the police station and destroyed his equipment. Somali police spokesman Abdi Fattah Adan Hassan told VOA that the police took immediate action after the incident and arrested one of the soldiers who assaulted the journalist. Another is still on the loose.
Balse way dhici karta shakhsiyaad xiran dharka dawladda inay bulshada dhibaateeyaan noocyada kala duwan.
Hassan said it is possible that individuals dressed in security forces uniform to cause problems against the public. I share the pain with the journalists who were attacked yesterday in Wadajir district. After the issues, I talked to Arladi Media and spoke to the police commissioner. And lastly, the individual that was responsible has been put behind bars in Wadajir. Somalia is one of the deadliest countries for journalists in the world, with more than 50 media workers killed since 2010. Reporters Without Borders ranked Somalia as the most dangerous country for journalists in Africa. Mohamed Daisane for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station,